referring to the old immigration laws.
Yeah, I was just listening to that. So Jeff Sessions, you know, in this interview you played yesterday, is celebrating the 1924 Act, the Reed-Johnson Act, or the Johnson-Reed Act, which closed the border for Jews. And I need to also emphasize for millions of people from other parts of the world, too. It wasn't just Jews, but we know the sort of consequences were catastrophic for Jews. But it's terrifying to me that Jeff Sessions is celebrating this act that we now know and regard, you know, is universally regarded as xenophobic and destructive and baseless and a terrible mark on this country's history.
We're going to have to leave it there. Lizzie Ratner, senior editor at The Nation, will link to her article, Nobody Wanted to Take Us In, the story of Jared Kushner's family and mine. And that does it for today's show. A correction. Our headlines on Wednesday included a claim by a man who told WJBK in Detroit that his mother, an Iraqi-American green card holder, died after being denied entry into the United States. An imam in Detroit has since told the station that the woman died in Iraq 5 days before the ban went into place. That does it for the show. Thanks for joining us.
On Friday, February 3rd, 2017, from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m., from the grassroots, where we agitate for social change with music and commentary, we'll agitate with the music of Frankie Beverly and Maze. Local and national political commentary provided by Landon Crowell. We will review Mayor Ted Wheeler's first 30 days in office. And musical analysis provided by our art historian, Diane Johnson. From the Grassroots on 90.7 FM, KBOO in Portland.
Good morning, good morning. I am Joanne Hardesty, and welcome to Voices from the Edge. It is my pleasure to have on the program today Jessica Jackson, and she's the National Director and Co-Founder of Cut 50. And it is a project that we're going to talk a bit about to cut the prison population by 50% over the next 10 years. I want to give you a little bit about Jessica's background before we start our conversation. Jessica Jackson Sloan is a human rights attorney who began her career representing California death row inmates in their appeals. She now oversees Dream Corps Cut 50 Initiative to end mass incarceration. Jessica currently sits on the Committee for a Fair Judiciary, serves as a board member of the American Constitution Society Bay Area chapter, represents Congressman Jared Huffman on the Democratic Central Committee of Marion, and serves on the Public Outreach Committee for the Marion Bar Association. She was elected to the Mill Valley City Council in November of 2013, becoming the youngest ever elected official in Marion County. In addition to her duties on the City Council, Jessica serves as Mill Valley's representative to the Association of Bay Area Governments, the Joint Service Oversight Committee, the Marion County Major Crimes Oversight Task Force, and the MCCMC Legislative Committee. And I do believe Jessica Jackson was recently elected mayor. And have you taken office yet?
Yes. First of all, thank you so much for having me on the show.
It is such a pleasure.
I actually took office on December 2nd as mayor of Mill Valley.
Well, congratulations on your election to mayor.
Thank you.
And this is an extremely timely conversation that we're going to have today based on what happened in Delaware just a short while ago. But first, let's talk about the Cut 50 initiative. It's my understanding this is a bipartisan effort that you co-founded with one of my favorite people on the planet, Van Jones.
He's one of my favorite people, too.
He's a powerhouse. And so tell me how this came about. How did this project come about?
Yes, so it's kind of a crazy story. So I actually set out in the world at 18. I was going to be an environmental activist, fired up, moved down to Georgia where my dad lived. And I met a boy, fell in love, as you do when you're 18.
Oh, yes.
A couple years later, we ended up getting married, and I was pregnant with my first child. Unfortunately, he developed a drug addiction. He was working late nights, started using methamphetamines, and just really became addicted to it. And he got caught fairly quickly with some drugs, and I got to see firsthand just how broken our criminal justice system was. Mm. So I had never had any experience with the criminal justice system before that moment. The only thing I knew is, you know, we have prisons. That's where you put bad people.
Mm-hmm.
What I found out is that's not where you put bad people. That's where you put good people who have made a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, they threw the book at him. He received a sentence of 15 years, served six. He ended up serving 3.5 of those years, and I remember standing there in the courtroom watching him go off to prison with my 2-month-old daughter in my hands and just thinking, I got to do more. Mm. I got to fix this. This is wrong. So I ended up going to college and law school. I say it very quickly now. It was obviously a very
difficult right. Didn't happen just overnight, huh?
Did not happen overnight. Took the bar exam, all of that. Ended up going into representing death row inmates here in California. And that's when I met your favorite person, my favorite person, Van Jones. So Van and I started talking about criminal justice work, and he'd sort of traveled the opposite path. He'd started out in criminal justice and gone into environmental work.
Mm-hmm.
So I was joking around with him at this dinner we were at, and I said, you know, there's people in cages. What are you doing, hugging trees? And he kind of looked at me like, didn't you just graduate law school? I just got out of the White House.
Yeah, right. What have you been doing for the last couple of years, right?
So we kept up the conversation. I think I tweeted a picture of me and him and said, you know, thanks for the conversation. And a couple weeks later, he wrote me back and he said, you know, I'm on this new show. It's called Crossfire. It's me and Newt Gingrich and S.E. Cupp and Stephanie Cutter. And we're sitting down every day and we're arguing left, right on all of the issues. He said, and I started to think about what you said about criminal justice reform. And I mentioned it to Newt Gingrich. And for the first time ever, Newt wasn't fighting me. He was agreeing.
Wow.
Yeah, right? He said, Newt Gingrich agrees the prison system is broken and we need to do something to fix it. So I flew out to D.C. and met with Newt Gingrich and Van. I was very lucky the night I came for the show. They actually had Rick Perry, governor of Texas, on the show as well. And strangely enough, he was agreeing with us.
Wow.
So we ended up hosting the first ever bipartisan summit on criminal justice reform, co-hosted by Pat Nolan from the American Conservative Union, Van Jones, Newt Gingrich, Donna Brazile. And we ended up getting over 84 speakers, everybody from Eric Holder to Governor Nathan Deal in Georgia, talking about the reforms he felt were important for his community and how he'd cut the incarceration rate of African Americans by 20%. And that's really where Cut 50 got started. It was a recognition that, hey, this isn't a Democratic issue, this isn't a Republican issue, this is a human issue, and it's time to do what's right.
Wow, I'm impressed. Just putting all those names together, just imagining all those people in the same room, just kind of makes you go, what?
Yeah, no, I've got pictures, and every once in a while during the campaign when I got down, I'd reflect on them. I'm like, all right, there's Eric Holder standing next to Rick Perry. Okay, it happened. It can get there again.
And so we understand that in America, we're spending about $80 billion every year on incarcerating people. Lots of that money we're spending in private, for-profit prisons that require a certain occupancy rate. We know that people who are more likely to go to prison are people who are less educated, more urban, more brown, and from communities that have been targeted for police action.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to throw out there, we hear a lot about the private for-profit prisons.
Right.
What we don't think about in that $80 billion is that the state prisons also are privatized in some ways. They've got the folks who are providing the telephone service,
right.
Global Tellink. When my husband was incarcerated, I had to pay $21 for a 15-minute phone call. $21. Now, what does that do? That meant I had to choose between, you know, food and diapers
right.
and whatnot for my baby
right.
and talking to my husband. And obviously, I wasn't going to not feed the kid.
Mm-hmm.
So it just broke apart our marriage. There are other companies, the canteen company, that we would have to go. We would put money on his books so he could buy some extra food.
Right.
And they would take a percentage of that money. And they would use that money, you know, they would give him the remainder. And when he went to collect his side, they would take a percentage of that, too.
So there,
there's a lot of privatization within the public prisons that's rarely, rarely talked about.
You raise an excellent point because you're right. I mean, if you think about all the services that take place inside prison, I know in Oregon we have a prison program that actually builds furniture or clothing mm-hmm. or does laundry in a constitutional mandate that prisoners work 40 hours a week, which means we basically have legalized slavery because we pay inmates a very nominal amount, less than a dollar, I believe, a day, to work 40 hours a week for some private industry that's making a lot of money.
Absolutely. My husband went in. He was an electrician. He'd had contracts all over Georgia before that. When he went in, they took him to a diagnostic facility. That's the first step once you've entered the prison. You wait at county for a little while after your sentence, and then you're taken into the diagnostic facility. They check, make sure, you know, what level are you going to be, what was your sentence, how is your health, how are you coming into us.
Mm-hmm.
And while they were there, they realized, one, he had some very valuable skills.
Right.
And two, you know, he was actually a pretty low-level guy. He'd just gotten mixed up doing some drugs.
Right.
So they ended up housing him out, sending him down to South Georgia to live in a county jail right by where they needed some work done, some construction work done, so he could work as an electrician. But then, you know, it sounds great. However, he went from making $35 an hour on the outside, which meant he could support his family,
right.
to making 52 cents an hour on the inside, which is nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, and so we are talking about, for the listeners who have just joined us, I am speaking with Jessica Jackson Sloan, and she's the mayor of Mill Valley, California, in addition to being co-founder of Cut 50, the fight to cut the prison population in half in 10 years. And so this project started when, Jessica?
So we launched in 2014.
Okay.
We've been at it a couple of years now, and I'm pleased to say we've actually seen quite a few successes.
And let's talk a little bit about some of the success you've seen. We certainly know that under the last president, there was a lot of commutation of sentences just as President Obama was leaving office. What else have you seen over the last couple of years?
Yeah, and just to touch on that,
mm-hmm.
we saw a historic level of clemencies.
Mm.
And it's not because Obama is a bleeding heart liberal.
Right, right.
It's because there were laws that had been changed for people on sentences going forward. But they didn't apply them backwards.
Right.
They didn't apply them to the folks who were already in prison.
Right.
So what you ended up with is people sitting there doing life for marijuana, and just clogging up the federal system and clogging up the federal prisons. And I had we launched our Clemency Now campaign, calling on the president to issue these clemencies, to go ahead and start getting folks home. And I had the pleasure of meeting a lot of their family members. We brought 75 different families to D.C. to talk to the DOJ and to rally at the White House and hold a vigil and speak about what was going on. And it was incredibly moving. I mean, the stories they had about their parents, their loved ones, having been incarcerated for 20, 30 years for these nonviolent drug offenses, it was heartbreaking. So we did see 1,715 of them come home, but there are still folks inside that did not get granted clemency or whose petitions weren't answered for clemency. So, you know, we're hoping that we'll pick back up with our clemency efforts, or even better, that Congress can go ahead and create a retroactive bill that will help some of these folks come home to their families.
And what is the likelihood, knowing what you know about the makeup of the current Congress, that you will be successful in trying to move forward legislation like that?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's kind of the question that's hanging out there.
Yeah, right.
We do know. I get this question a lot.
Yeah, I bet.
What we do know is that we have built some incredible bipartisan coalitions even within Congress.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've seen John Boehner calling for criminal justice reform, and then shortly after he left office, Paul Ryan picked it right back up and started calling for criminal justice reform. And if any of your listeners or you have any interest, we actually did a campaign, Justice Reform Now, and it was calling for federal legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a extremely powerful woman by the name of Alicia Keys as our spokesperson. So the story gets cooler. Not only do
yes,
I get to work
does.
With you know, Van Jones, but now I get to work with Alicia Keys, too.
Okay, I'm really jealous now, okay? Clearly, I took the wrong path in life.
It's a fun job, I can't lie. But we had Alicia Keys come up to Congress and speak to, you know, a room of just 300 staffers and members about the need for criminal justice reform and tell some of these stories. And then we had her make a Valentine's video for Paul Ryan, asking him to bring criminal justice reform to a vote. You can find that on YouTube or on our website, cut50.org. And he was asked about it on Fox 2 days later. And, you know, he turned about five shades of red. Kind of a flirty video with Alicia Keys asking Paul Ryan to be her Valentine.
Right, right.
But he did commit to bringing it to a vote. So we saw a package of bills in the House make it out of the committee just last year. It was introduced by Representative Goodlatte from Virginia. And we're likely going to see that same package or a very similar package introduced this legislative session once we've kind of gotten through this Supreme Court nomination.
Oh, well, we hope. If you're
knock
just
on wood.
Right, knock on wood. If you're just joining the conversation, I'm speaking with Jessica Jackson Sloan. She's the mayor of Mill Valley, California, and national director and co-founder of Cut 50, the fight to slash the prison population by 50% in 10 years. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. So, Jessica, in light of, I mean, I think this is an absolutely necessary and wonderful program. I'm thrilled that it's a bipartisan effort because, as you know, we got here because of legislators from both parties trying to be tougher than each other on crime. And so the enhanced penalties, the aggressive mandatory minimum sentencing laws that were passed all across the country. I know you in California have a three-strike-you're-out law. We in Oregon have a one-strike-you're-out law that requires mandatory minimum sentences of 15-year-olds and up. And so we tend to just not address the fact that juvenile brains operate differently here in Oregon.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I'm glad you brought up Oregon. I wasn't going to start out the phone call by giving you bad news. But Oregon's actually got one of the worst criminal justice systems in the entire country.
Yes.
Which is surprising. You think of Mississippi, you think of Alabama, Louisiana.
Yes.
But it's, you know, actually Oregon with all their resources and you know, liberal politics. So you might ask why, and I think, you know, unfortunately.
That's going to be my next question, right?
Prosecutors are actually large to blame, largely to blame for this. So they're incarcerating a much higher percentage of African-American population than Alabama, Florida, and Louisiana. And then I would say, you know, these are folks who are being elected.
Yes.
They're very, very powerful forces within the criminal justice system that are kind of helping us to explain the gap between the two seemingly incompatible organs, the one where the governor has placed a moratorium on executions.
Right.
And then the one where, you know, the racially disparate criminal justice laws and enforcement policies have led to it being the seventh highest rate of black imprisonment in the entire nation.
It, pretty frightening in a state with a 2% black population. And so it definitely, we absolutely know that we have some critical issues, and primarily because DAs tend to be in office for life because they tend to not have competition in their elections. And so we end up with people spending their entire career inside district attorney's offices. And so there are a lot of efforts that are taking place right now. But again, I think we are, in fact, so bad off because most folks take a hand-off approach to the DA as if they have some special knowledge, and therefore we shouldn't question them. But I will say that currently the DA is looking at declassifying many crimes in Oregon and crimes that we consider crimes of being poor, right? Because we have a system that if you're poor and black, you're 600 times more likely to be charged with a crime in Multnomah County, based on a recent study that was released. So we've got work to do here, no doubt. And I believe we have a caller on the phone.
Oh, great.
Good morning, Joe. Welcome to KBOO. Hi, Joe. Are you there?
This is Herschel.
Oh, Herschel. Hi, Herschel. I'm sorry. I got bad info.
Okay.
Good morning. Welcome to KBOO.
I'm interested in having prisoners vote. I mean, I think conditions in prisons would be so much different if they had a representative there.
Mm.
So I wondered if this person on here, Jessica, knows about any work being done or somebody I could contact or anything to kind of move this thing forward. I mean, they count these people in prison when they draw up the districts, but then they don't get the vote. So really, the rural districts get more representation than the rest of us. So I don't know.
Oh, well, that's another whole can of worms you've just opened. But let me say that in the city jails, prisoners can vote in the city jail. The only people who cannot vote in Oregon are people who are incarcerated at the state level in prisons.
Okay.
But Jessica, do you have any info about any national effort to get the vote for prisoners?
Yeah, I was going to say, so it does change state by state. The laws are going to change. So you got to really just dial in into your state and look at what's going on in Oregon. I would probably check with some of the national voting rights organizations. What's interesting is that we know there's about 65 to 70 million people in America with a criminal record, and many of them still can't vote. So you start to think about our last election and where things ended up and the fact that it was really determined by about 80,000 people, and what the repercussion would have been if people with criminal convictions or people in prisons or people who are in the jails could vote. It could have completely changed the election.
Absolutely. And Herschel raised another really interesting point that doesn't get enough public airing, which is how the census counts populations, prison populations, as part of the local community. However, at least in Oregon, state law requires prisoners to go back to their home county, but those resources don't follow those prisoners back to their home county. It stays in the county. And so and most of our jails are in rural areas, so you can imagine how the demographic shift happens when you build a prison in a rural community and then the resources stay in that community.
Yeah, absolutely. And that also varies state by state. Here in California, you count folks in the county that they're incarcerated. So I live here in Marin County,
right,
which is one of those super zips, so top 5% of income, top 5% of schools. And I was looking at our demographic numbers one day, trying to figure out, you know, where are folks? Because it seems like a very homogenous society when you drive through our community. And what I found out is 50% of the African Americans who, quote-unquote, live in our community, in our county,
right,
live in San Quentin State Prison.
Whoa.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it definitely skews data for a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
And it also says something, you know, pretty harsh about the community we're living in here. But like you said, it really actually disrupts the resource allocation and the voting. So, you know, I'm not sure what the answers are going to be, but on a state-by-state level, this is something that absolutely needs to get addressed.
Absolutely. Do we have another caller on the line? Good morning, Joe. Welcome to KBOO. Hello, Joe. Are you there? I think we may have lost Joe. Hopefully,
no, we got to get Joe's
here.
Some coffee.
Can you hear me?
Oh, yes, I hear you now, Joe.
Okay.
Did you go get coffee? You're back.
Yeah. Well, I've been waiting 6 minutes. Anyway, I got two suggestions. Why aren't prisoners in a union, and why aren't the monies that they earn going into a fund so that when they get out, they got something to get by on? And why aren't there more educational materials, used textbooks, all kinds of technical books behind bars? And based on my limited experience in the county, there's like nothing. And you don't get your right to vote. We tried that. It didn't work.
Well, what do you mean? What do you mean you tried it and it didn't work?
Well, I happened to be in while there was an election going on, and I sent out a kite, you know, where's my ballot? And like nothing.
Were you registered?
Huh?
Were you registered?
Yeah, I'm sure the ballot was sitting in my mailbox anyway. I couldn't get to it. But, yeah, a prisoner's union and, you know, fair wages and the money going into a fund, maybe victims' restitution possibly for some of it, but certainly a fund so that when they get out, they got something to get by on.
You've got fabulous questions. I'm going to leave it to my expert to try to answer, and I will come back and tell you what I know about Oregon's law.
Yeah, so you bring up a really great point. And actually, it's funny because I heard the same point recently from the mouth of a man who is incarcerated in San Quentin prison. They call him Wall Street. And if you look up Wall Street, the Oracle of San Quentin, you'll understand why. He came to prison unable to read or write as a young child. Grew up in the prison system, and apparently he was following sports, so he went to go get a newspaper one day and picked up the wrong section. He was going to have his cellie read to him. He accidentally picked up the stock section. So he brought it back, and somebody said, oh, you play stocks? And he said, no, what is that? And they said, well, that's where the white people keep their money. So he was motivated at that moment to learn more about finances and financial literacy. So first he taught himself how to read. And then he started to read about Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and all these incredible, you know, venture capitalists and what they were doing and how their economic models worked. And he started to look around and realize that nobody in there was saving.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think it's hard for somebody who's making, you know, 50 cents an hour to save, but he was looking at the guards, too, and talking to them about their finances and hearing them complain about living paycheck to paycheck while driving an Escalade, right? So he started teaching a financial literacy course, and through that course, he's been teaching men on the inside how to save their money so that when they come out, they're not walking out with $200 from the prison and a bus ticket somewhere. They're actually coming out with something that, you know, can get them by for a couple months while they go ahead and look for jobs and try and get their lives on track. So he's teaching them financial literacy and savings. Now, I think that should be in every prison.
Right.
And I don't think we should have to have, you know, one brilliant man within the prison walls coming up with it. It's great that San Quentin's got him, but there's only one Wall Street. So I think we should have that sort of financial literacy training in every single prison. Yeah. And I would actually argue we should have it in every single high school across yes. this country as well, because a lot of crimes are economic crimes.
Yes.
I don't remember anybody ever teaching me in school, you know, this is how you open a checking account. This is a credit card. This is an interest rate. This is how you'll get in trouble. With an interest rate or a payday loan or any of that. This is how you save. The only time I think I ever heard anything about money outside of my own home was at church. You know, you give us 10%. So I think it's a very important skill that should start even before our jails and prisons. It's something that should be taught in our high schools. But it should definitely be taught in jails and prisons as well. And then you also touched on a point of textbooks and rehabilitative programs.
Mm-hmm.
And what we know is if you have access to learning and programs and arts and media in the prisons and you're developing these skills, you're going to be much more likely to succeed when you come home from prison.
Right.
So what we've seen is a lot of those programs have been cut for budget reasons, which is insane when you look at the fact that we're still spending $80 billion a year on this incarceration industry.
Yes.
So we've got to reduce that prison population. We've got to invest the dollars that we're paying for each person we're keeping in there, not into third-party private companies, but instead into actually rehabilitating them and giving them access to grow as individuals and come out and be successful.
Well, and I don't know if this is true in California, but in Oregon, certainly we used to have really excellent education programs, job programs within the prison. But that was before our politicians started the tough on crime. Prisoners are unworthy. They're undeserving. And so we've taken all those programs out, and then somehow we expect people to come out and get a full-time job, be able to take care of their family, be able to pay all their court costs. I know in Oregon we give people $50 and a bus ticket and then say, get a job, get a place to live, be put into your parole or probation officer, pay any fines or restitution that's required by the court, and do all that within the next 30 days, because otherwise you face going back to prison. So we really do set people up for failure rather than to help them successfully transition
Absolutely.
Back into the community. So what's next? You were just starting to tell me about some of the successes. We started with the clemencies that former President Obama did. What else are you proud of your accomplishments since you've started?
You know, I think one of my biggest accomplishments, one of our biggest accomplishments at CUF50 has just been raising this issue in the media.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've really focused in on humanizing the issue, telling the stories of people who are impacted. And when Newt and Van and Donna and Pat and all of us held that bipartisan summit, criminal justice reform really wasn't something that was being talked about in the mainstream media.
Right.
Or if it was, you know, it would come up when there had been a terrible shooting
yes.
or some other crime that was committed.
Yes.
So we really had to start with the emotional part, the opening of the heart space, the
mm-hmm.
telling the stories of the people who are impacted. You mentioned sort of low-level financial punishments that end up getting people into prisons. We ran this fines and fees campaign last year that you can find on our website, cut50.org, where we had multiple celebrities come out and write op-eds about some of the work being done around the country to combat this fines and fees issue, where, you know, somebody goes and drives and makes an illegal left-hand turn, they get a ticket,
right.
something we've all done. Unfortunately, this person can't afford that ticket, so they end up getting a warrant out for their arrest and ending up in jail, where they're just costing taxpayers even more money than, you know, that ticket would have been to write off.
Yes.
So we did a six-part series really focusing in on this issue. And we also put out some videos talking about the issue of fines and fees. And interestingly, it's one of those areas where there's a lot of bipartisan agreement that, you know, people shouldn't be in jails just because they're poor. So we started telling their stories. And what I've found is, you know, we've really made a lot of headway. We've gone from nobody talking about criminal justice reform, unless there was a terrible, terrible crime committed,
right,
to having every single presidential debate, it came up. You know, and we had folks on the Republican stage talking about the need for the criminal justice reform, and folks on the Democratic stage, you know, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, competing over who would have a better plan and policy to start cutting our prisons. So it was just phenomenal work in changing the narrative in a very short time that I see as a huge success.
So, Jessica, I'm really curious as to how are you getting all these big-name people to be a part of this campaign? Because it feels, because I, you know, I'm thinking Alicia Keys, right? And
yeah.
I'm looking at your website and you've got Omar Epps and you've got Alicia Silverstone and you've got Malik Yoba and Russell Simmons and names that are well known in the entertainment field and actors and actresses. And I think that there's a method to your madness. So explain, please, how you've been able to get them and why they appear to be good spokespeople for this cause.
Yeah. So I think, you know, the one amazing thing of having celebrities endorsing your cause and getting involved in your movement is they bring with them, you know, their own audience.
Right.
So you're reaching people that you never would have been able to reach before.
Mm-hmm.
Only so many people are going to be following Van on Twitter. Right. Only so many people are going to follow Newt on Twitter. And by the way, there's not much overlap in those two.
Okay, some things are normal.
You know, you got somebody like Alicia Keys. She's mm-hmm. got 33 million
followers.
Folks following her,
wow.
You know, and so it's just an incredible opportunity to really get your message out to a new group of people.
Mm-hmm.
And why they're doing it, you know, it's been in my experience that it's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you can make a lot of headway when you're fighting for the right cause and when you're telling people, look, come join us, come make progress, because there are men and women across this country who are separated from their families by bars that don't need to be there.
Yes.
And they're costing us taxpayer dollars that could be preventing crimes or could be educating your children or could be providing public health services that are desperately needed in our communities. So I think there's a little bit of everything for folks who are interested in all sorts of issues in the criminal justice fight. And I'm really proud of the work we've been able to do to build the bipartisan coalitions and to get these celeb spokespeople on, repeating our messages and joining in the conversation and bringing with them, you know, all of their followers into the conversation.
Yes, it sounds like it certainly has been a working strategy that has led to some really good outcomes. But as we move forward, as we think about the current Congress and what I've heard so far, at least from I just want to say president-elect, but I guess he's actually taken office.
Yeah.
What I've heard is really just the opposite, right? That he's going back to this method of what urban communities need are more police and less civil rights, because you know, he's already talking about defunding the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division. So I'm just wondering. Of course, you have to work with what you have. How do you take the opportunity to create reform under an administration that doesn't appear to be reform-minded?
Yeah, no, I think that's something we're still figuring out.
Mm-hmm.
We've heard this really heavy law enforcement message.
Yes.
And we've heard a real concern for violent crimes that are occurring. So what we do know is that our resource allocation right now is completely skewed in the criminal justice system.
Yes.
I started talking earlier about, you know, our clemency initiative and how many people were caught up in the clemency initiative that were eligible for clemency under Obama. The criteria for them to be eligible was that they had to have been in there at least 10 years, never had a violent crime or any violent write-up while in prison, And they had to have been a first-time, low-level, no affiliation to gangs or being kingpins or anything like that, drug offender. So when you start thinking about who's in our prisons, you realize it's not the violent criminals that are clogging up the system, right? There's a whole lot of low-level folks. And when I say it's not the violent criminals, yeah, there's some people who've committed violent acts. And you know what? I think they should get out, too, because they're in there, but they're capable of rehabilitation as well. So I think Mr. Trump is a businessman. President Trump is a businessman. And I think if we were to have a conversation with him, I'd ask him why he would want to continue to invest $80 billion a year in a business, essentially, that's failing 74% of the time to achieve its stated outcome of keeping our community safer. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something he's going to have to tangle with, because by the time he is up for re-election in 2020, the Bureau of Prisons is going to be 40% of the Department of Justice's budget.
Wow.
He's going to have to make some really tough decisions then as to where he goes with policies, if he wants to continue to lock up these low-level offenders and spend money on it, or if he wants to free up money for crime prevention and crime enforcement.
Excellent. We have a couple of callers on the line. Good morning, Nancy. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning, Joanne.
Good morning.
One of the things that Trump has made clear is going after our drinking water all over the United States. That's the infrastructure repair that's required. Most of the systems in most places are in need of repair immediately, and our system is one of them. It's 100 years old, and they're starting that process. And our state treasurer put in a bill before the legislature that the private banks would own the debt of fixing that infrastructure, so you know what that means, that poor people will be without water because they can't afford it. So that's a very critical issue for the communities here, and it also creates a prison population because people are physically and mentally affected by the quality of the water and the cost and whether they even have it available. Because we have the human right to water. We signed on to the treaty for the UN, and we only trickle in water in the winter. And what happens to people when they're freezing conditions like there have been and will continue to be this winter? So that's my question, prevention.
Thanks, Nancy. Appreciate the call. I don't know if you have a response about water and...
Yeah, I would just say, you know, one of the brilliant things about Van's organization, the Dream Corps, is that we're not just closing prison doors. We're also opening the doors of opportunity. So
yes.
There are three different initiatives at the Dream Corps. Cut 50... then there is the Yes We Code, which is focused on getting folks from disenfranchised neighborhoods into great coding jobs and getting them their own careers where they can actually make a sustainable living. And then we've got Green for All, which has been an incredible force in environmental politics and has worked very hard on not just the Green Jobs Act and implementing that, but on solar industry and creating clean tech jobs and really elevating folks from black and brown communities into positions of leadership.
Yes.
In these industries. So one of the great things is that we can work across silos. If there are ways to create opportunities for people coming home from prisons to work in environmental arenas, you know, they know better than anybody what their lack of access to clean water or nutritious food was while they were incarcerated. And we're hoping that we're able to create some clean tech jobs for them as well, and help use the knowledge of the folks inside to really solve some of these difficult systemic issues.
And we certainly use Green for All as an example of how you can take people with very limited skills and create living wage job opportunities for them. So we're absolutely very familiar and very connected into that Green for All, both philosophy and the work that's been done by Van Jones and others nationally around that. We've got several other callers on the line. Good morning, Connor. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to ask a question that was brought up before regarding private companies and public prisons.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand one of the companies is Aramark Correctional. And the way I understand it, and I can speak from experience, I spent a night in jail when I was younger, and the food that they give you is you know, garbage. And the way I understand how Aramark Correctional works is that, again, your guest mentioned that families are targeted to donate money to their prisoners, their family members' accounts.
Right.
And then these prisoners can use this money in this cantina where they're sort of, they take money off of both ends. It's unconscionable allowing a private company to do that while you feed prisoners garbage.
Right.
So I'm wondering, you know, I know Aramark is a big company. I've worked for Aramark. They're all over sports arenas and other places, food services all over the nation. I'm just wondering if she can comment on any opportunities for boycotting Aramark, and also if there are any ways to sort of, or any, I'm, to bypass private companies and for just people that are outside to donate real food to prisoners in the system.
Thank you for the question.
Yeah, happy to dive in on this one. And the solution I want to offer is not to boycott. The solution I want to offer is to boycott. I believe strongly that what we're seeing now is an opportunity for corporations to step up and start giving people jobs as they're coming home. Mm. We've seen Ban the Box pass in many states.
Yes.
We've seen other companies such as Hot Chicken Takeover over in Ohio, or Dave's Killer Bread with Flowers Foods, hiring formerly incarcerated individuals and having incredible successes doing so. In fact, we held a reentry summit just last December, and we had folks from different companies that hire formerly incarcerated speaking to about 150 Bay Area employers here in the Bay Area about it. And the stories they were telling and the testimony they were giving, each and every one of those employers said absolutely 100% all I want to hire at this point is formerly incarcerated because they are so happy to have a job and they work so incredibly hard that it's just an incredible experience for everybody. So what we've decided at Cut 50 is we want to organize a boycott. We want to ask consumers to be putting their money into these companies that are providing jobs for people as they're coming home. You brought up the food quality issue. There are a lot of places that are hiring formerly incarcerated individuals to work in the food services. I know Tyson's Chicken is one of them. There's lots of companies on our website. Probably in the next couple weeks, you're going to see a list pop up that talks about some of the companies we need to be boycotting and spending our money at so that they start to provide even more jobs for formerly incarcerated folks. And then other corporations start to notice and start to do the same.
That is an excellent idea. Yes, you want to reinforce the good behavior and actually applaud companies who are doing the right thing. I mean, I think that's key. If you're going to reduce the recidivism rate, people have to be able to feed their family. So we're going to go back to the phone line. Good morning, Mike. Welcome to KBOO.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
So, first of all, you know, I'm listening to people speak, and it seems like there's a lot of naivety that's being presented. First of all, we have to, people in the prisons, especially the illegal immigrants, you can't, you know, I don't think Americans should be involved in trying to rehabilitate the illegal immigrants that are in our prison systems. And also, we need to look at prisons as universities. And once prisoners get into the prison systems, particularly the illegitimate capitalists, the ones that's in there for money crimes, drug dealers, or other types of crimes involving money, these people aren't going to be rehabilitated because, you know, they want to be capitalists. It's just that they don't want to go through the normal process of trying to attain their money.
So, Mike, I just got to stop you because
have you been to prison? Have you been in there?
I have visited every single prison in Oregon, and I did it on a regular basis when I was a state legislator. And I have sat down and talked to the prison clubs, the lifer clubs. Yes, I have.
But I'm trying to tell you, the only segment of that prison population that you can rehabilitate are the people that are political in there. If you talk to the political people, yeah, I think you might be able to rehabilitate them. But you're not going to rehabilitate an illegitimate capitalist.
People so I disagree, Mike, and I'm going to have to cut you off because... Mike, it is not a fact. I want to correct what people's immigration status is really irrelevant to why they're in prison unless we are cooperating with ICE, which is against state law in Oregon. And so if someone is in prison, we're not asking what their immigration status is. That's not appropriate. That's not an appropriate topic of conversation. That's one. Number two, people get into prison for a whole lot of reasons. And this program has primarily been really focused on how easy it is for poor people to get into prison and whether or not prison is the right place for poor people who've committed these poor people crimes. That's what we're talking about. And so I just need to cut you off because you're going down a path that just won't work for us. Have a good day. Jessica, any comments?
Yeah. I was going to say, you know, in terms of illegal immigration, and I think that's something he brought up,
mm-hmm.
We're looking at a possible situation where we're going to have a president not only building this wall, but also passing felony statutes that make it illegal to come into this country illegally, but punishable by a certain amount of time in prison, right?
Yes.
So what we're going to look at is the opposite effect if all this goes through,
right.
Where we're actually having more illegal immigrants stuck here in the United States, supported by taxpayer dollars, in our prisons for coming in without proper documentation. So it's interesting he brings that up as a point because we're actually we're standing at a time where there might be more undocumented humans who are kept behind our prison walls under this administration. And that's something Cut 50 is not actively working on right now, but mm-hmm. is very concerned about.
Well, and of course, we've had protests all over the country, including here and at the Portland airport. Really an opposition. And I know that the ACLU and Oregon Unite filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration yesterday in opposition to the Muslim travel ban. I think it's troubling. And I cut Michael off because Michael calls a lot because he is unhappy with people who arrive in the U.S. without documentation. But I just need to keep reminding him that people are never illegal. It is the actions that they take that may be lawful or not.
Absolutely.
But so I appreciate that. Do we have any other callers? Good morning, Brian. Welcome to KBOO.
Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Talking about the food in prison and stuff, I don't know if you've heard of the famous Scottish chef Gordon Ramsay. But he did a program. He went into several British prisons and taught the inmates how to cook. And some of them have actually come out and become, chefs.
Ah.
And so that's one solution I think would be very fertile. And, to me, food is one of the great languages of the world.
True.
I'm a food fanatic myself.
And, me too.
And love to cook and, anyway, that's just one of my suggestions that to me there's something very healing and, almost spiritual about cooking, not at a frantic pace that you sometimes get in a professional restaurant, but still, it's allowed some of these guys to come out and get jobs, and I don't know what the recidivism rate was, but it was very, very low.
Mm.
And he made a couple of shows out of it, and he, they were obviously enjoying it very much, so that's my little 10 cents worth, and thank you for having me.
Wow, I'm going to have to check that out.
I certainly appreciate your call as well. Jessica, we're getting minus on minutes, and I don't want to leave the program without talking about the uprising that took place recently in Delaware. Are you familiar with?
Yes. Yes.
So what do you think was the cause of the uprising, and kind of any thoughts you have on it at the moment?
Yeah. So first, I just wanted to say, you know, a lot of the time when we've been out there talking to folks about cutting the prison population, and of course they talk to me about, well, you want to cut half, that means you want to let all these crazy people out,
mm-hmm.
You know, crime's just going to rise. And actually what we've seen is it's the opposite. Crime actually rises when we're incarcerating more people.
Right.
And crime actually falls when we're handling the criminal justice system differently and not incarcerating as many people, but instead addressing the underlying crime. So Delaware is sort of a prime example of this. In Delaware, the prisons are actually 150% capacity. I think they're actually over 150% capacity.
Wow.
And interestingly, the recidivism rates, the rate of somebody getting out of prison and coming back to prison, is approaching 100%.
Wow.
I mean, that's incredible. And just by way of example, you look at a country like Norway or Sweden, their recidivism rate is 14%.
Wow.
Now, I'm half Swedish, but that doesn't mean I'm biased. Smarter, whatever. What it does mean is that I've had the opportunity to really look at these prisons and realize the reason for this is that they're treating people like humans when they're inside, and they're giving them the programming and the wraparound services and the mental health care and the physical health care and providing the training skills and holding their hand as they get off whatever they were on before they got in there. And they're helping them find jobs when they get out and helping them find housing and all of these essentials to really flourish.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, we're not doing that here in America, at least not on a large enough scale. And in Delaware, we're seeing that this is even worse. The prisons who are in the prisons are actually routinely reporting improper treatment. Their 10% of the prisoners are placed in solitary confinement, not over the course of their lives, but at any given moment, 10% of their prison is in solitary confinement.
Yes.
The incarceration system in Delaware is also extremely clearly racially motivated, which adds some fuel to the fire. So 6 out of 10 of the people behind bars there in the state of Delaware are black, even though African-Americans commit far less than 60% of the crime and much, much, much less of the violent crime, and are an even smaller fraction of the population. So we're looking at some huge racial disparities, so unfair policing practices. You know, you talked earlier about district attorneys and the role that they play in all of this. So you're obviously seeing some implicit racial bias built into the system in the charging, which is done by the district attorneys.
Right.
And you're just seeing this incredibly improper treatment of folks when they are in prison, and just a complete disregard for their mental health as they're being confined in solitary confinement, which we know is devastating and traumatic to anybody who goes in there, much less, you know, folks from a more vulnerable population with higher rates of mental illness.
Absolutely true. You know, it's interesting. Today's Portland Tribune front page article is the high cost of being black in Multnomah County. And I just want to share the first two sentences with you. For everything from jaywalking to driving without a license, it pays to be white in Oregon if you run afoul of the law. What you really don't want to be is black. And then it goes on to talk about the median fine if you're white for jaywalking is $181. If you're black, it's $261. And then it goes on and on and on. So, and so for the smug Oregonians who are listening to this going, oh, not us. We're like, we're not that bad. Pick up a copy of the Tribune. I want to thank you so, so, so much, Jessica Jackson Sloan. It is such a pleasure hearing about your program. And I look forward to hearing more about Cut 50. I'm Joanne Hardesty, and I'll see you next week, same time, same place, same station. Have a great day.
Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Stand up.
And good morning. It is KBOO Portland, your community radio station. Coming up in a half hour, Fight the Empire is on with Per Fogring. And today he welcomes Daniel Lazar to discuss the mainstream media's Vladimir Putin obsession and how he's scapegoated for the U.S. election outcome and more. And then at 10 o'clock, we've got Chris Andre hosting Air Cascadia. 10:15, Flashpoints. At 11 today, Between the Covers, we'll be talking to Max Nemtsov about his Russian translation of the classic Gravity's Rainbow. And at 11:30, it's Black Book Talk. Today, presenting Portland native Renee Watson and her new work, Piecing Me Together. That is all coming up, but first we've got a special program, Between the Lines Radio, today looking at the legal challenge that temporarily blocked the Muslim ban, massive protests signaling the rebirth of a U.S. progressive movement, and criminal justice policy under Trump. That is all coming up in just a minute here on KBOO.
Hey, it's Shenna from Pacific Underground, the radio show where Asians and Pacific Islanders take the mic into our own hands. Join us this Friday at 9 a.m. for a special live episode where the entire Pacific Underground crew will join me for a lively roundtable discussion about new political policies affecting Asians and Pacific Islanders. We'll also have live interviews and we'll be taking your calls to talk about what's important to you and your API community. So tune in for a special Pacific Underground this Friday, February 3rd at 9 a.m. right here on KBOO, your community radio station.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Pardis Cabrai of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who examines the Constitution.